But Cuthbert sighed.
It was a South American expedition that took place over 5 years ago. It was not entirely successful.
It was a disaster, Frock said derisively.
Oblivious to Cuthbert's angry glance, he continued.
It caused a scandal in the museum at the time. The expedition broke up early due to personality conflicts. Some of the expedition members were killed by hostile tribesmen. The rest were killed in a plane crash on the way back to New York. There were the inevitable rumors of a curse, that kind of thing.
That's an exaggeration, Cuthbert snapped. There was no scandal of any sort.
Pendergast looked at them.
And the crates? He said mildly.
They were shipped back separately, Cuthbert said. But this is all beside the point. There was a very unusual object in one of these crates, a figurine created by an extinct South American tribe. It's to be an important element in the superstition exhibition.
Pendergast nodded.
Go on. Last week, when we went to retrieve the figurine, I found that one of the crates had been broken into.
He pointed.
So I ordered all of the crates moved temporarily to the secure area.
What was taken?
Well, now that was a little odd, said Cuthbert. None of the artifacts were missing from the crate. The figurine itself is worth a fortune. It's unique, the only one of its kind in the world. The Catoga tribe that made it was, it seems, vanished years ago.
You mean nothing was missing? Pendergast asked.
Well, nothing important. The only thing that seemed to be missing were the seed pods, or whatever they were. Maxwell, the scientist who packed them, died in the plane crash near Asuncion.
Seed pods? Asked Pendergast.
I honestly don't know what they were. None of the documentation survived except for the anthropological material. We had Whittlesey's journal, you see, but that was all. There was a little reconstructive work done when the crates first came back, but since then...
He stopped. You better tell me about this expedition, said Pendergast.
There's not much to tell. They had originally assembled to search for traces of the Catoga tribe and to do a survey and general collection in a very remote area of the rainforest. I think the preliminary work estimated that 95% of the plant species in the area were unknown to science. Whittlesey, an anthropologist, was the leader. I believe there was also a paleontologist, a mammalogist, perhaps an entomologist, a few assistants. Whittlesey and an assistant named Crocker disappeared and were probably killed by tribesmen. The rest died in the plane crash. The only thing we had any documentation on was the figurine from Whittlesey's journal. The rest of the stuff is just a mystery. No locality data, nothing.
Why did the material sit in these crates for so long? Why wasn't it unpacked and catalogued and put in the collections? Cuthbert stirred uncomfortably.
Well, he said defensively, ask Frock. He's the chairman of the department.
Our collections are enormous, said Frock. We have dinosaur bones still crated up from the 1930s that have never been touched. It costs a tremendous amount of money and time to curate these things, he sighed. But in this particular case, it's not a question of mere oversight. As I recall, the anthropology department was forbidden to curate these crates upon their return.
He looked pointedly at Cuthbert.
That was years ago,
Cuthbert replied acidly. How do you know there are no rare artifacts in the unopened boxes? Pendergast asked.
Whittlesey's journal implied that the figurine in the small crate was the only item of importance.
May I see this journal? Cuthbert shook his head.
It's gone. Missing.
Were the crates moved on your own authority?
I suggested it to Dr. Wright after I learned the crates had been tampered with,
Cuthbert said.
We kept the material together in its original crates until it could be curated. That's one of the museum's rules.
So the crates were moved late last week, Pendergast murmured, almost to himself. Just prior to the killing of the two boys. What could the killer have been after? Then he looked back at Cuthbert.
What did you say had been taken from the crates? Seed pods, was it?
Cuthbert shrugged.
As I said, I'm not sure what they were.
They look like seed pods to me, but I'm no botanist.
Can you describe them?
It's been years, I don't really remember. Big, round, heavy, rugose on the outside, light brown color. I've only seen the inside of the crate twice, you understand. Once when it first came back, then last week looking for Mbun. That's the figurine.
Where's the figurine now? Pendergast asked.
It's being curated for the show. It should be on display already. We're sealing the exhibition today.
Did you remove anything else from the box?
No. The figurine is the unique piece of the lot.
I would like to arrange to see it, said Pendergast.
Cuthbert shifted irritably on his feet.
You can see it when the show opens. Frankly, I don't know what you're up to. Why waste time on a broken crate when there's a serial killer loose in the museum and you chaps can't even find him?
Frock cleared his throat.
Margot, bring me closer, if you will, he asked.
Margot wheeled him over to the crates. With a grunt, he bent forward to scrutinize the broken boards. Everyone watched.
Thank you, he said, straightening up.
He eyed the group one at a time.
Please note that these boards are scored on the inside as well as the outside, he said finally. Mr. Pendergast, are we not making an assumption here? He finally said.
I never make assumptions, replied Pendergast with a smile.
But you are, Frock persisted. All of you are making an assumption that someone or something broke into the crate.
There was a sudden silence in the vault. Margot could smell the dust in the air and the faint odor of excelsior. And then Cuthbert began to laugh raucously, the sound swelling harshly through the chamber. As they approached Frock's office once again, the curator was unusually animated.
Did you see that cast? He said to Margot. Avian attributes, dinosaurian morphology. This could be the very thing.
He could scarcely contain himself. But Professor Frock, Mr. Pendergast believes it was constructed as a weapon of some sort, Margot said quickly. As she said it, she realized that she wanted to believe it too.
Stuff, Frock snorted. Didn't you get the sense, looking at that cast, of something tantalizingly familiar, yet utterly foreign? We're looking at an evolutionary aberration, the vindication of my theory.
Inside the office, Frock immediately produced a notebook from his jacket pocket and started scribbling. But Professor, how could such a creature... Margot stopped as she felt Frock's hand close over hers. His grip was extraordinarily strong.
My dear girl, he said, there are more things in heaven and earth, as Hamlet observed. It isn't always for us to speculate. Sometimes we must simply observe.
His voice was low, but he trembled with excitement.
We can't miss this opportunity, do you hear? Damn this steel prison of mine. You must be my eyes and ears, Margot. You must go everywhere, search up and down, be an extension of my fingers. We must not let this chance pass us by. Are you willing, Margot?
He gripped her hand tighter. 19. The old freight elevator in Section 28 of the museum always smelled like something had died in it, Smithback thought. He tried breathing through his mouth. The elevator was huge, the size of a Manhattan studio, and the operator had decorated it with a table, chair, and pictures cut from the museum's Nature magazine. The pictures focused on a single subject. There were giraffes rubbing necks, insects mating, a baboon displaying its rump, native women with pendulous breasts.
You like my little art gallery?
The elevator man asked with a leer. He was about 60 years old and wore an orange toupee.
It's nice to see someone so interested in natural history, Smithback said sarcastically.
As he stepped out, the smell of rotting flesh hit him with redoubled force. It seemed to fill the air like a Maine fog.
How do you stand it? He managed to gasp to the elevator man.
Stand what?
The man said, pausing as he rolled the hoistway doors shut. A cheerful voice came ringing down the corridor.
Welcome!
An elderly man shouted over the sound of the forced air ducts as he grasped Smithback's hand.
Nothing but zebra cooking today. You miss the rhinoceros. But come in anyway. Come in, please.
Smithback knew his thick accent was Austrian. Jost van Oster ran the osteological preparation area, the museum laboratory in which animal carcasses were reduced to bones. He was over 80, but looked so pink, cheerful, and plump that most people thought he was much younger. Von Oster had started at the museum in the late 20s, preparing and mounting skeletons for display. His crowning achievement in those days had been a series of horse skeletons, mounted walking, trotting, and galloping. It was said that these skeletons had revolutionized the way animals were exhibited. Von Oster had then turned to creating the lifelike habitat groups popular in the 40s, making sure every detail, down to the saliva on an animal's mouth, looked perfectly real. But the era of the habitat group had passed, and Von Oster had eventually been relegated to the bug room. Disdaining all offers of retirement, he cheerfully presided over the osteological lab, where animals, now mostly collected from zoos, were turned into clean white bones for study or mounting. However, his old skills as a master habitat sculptor were still intact, and he had been called in to work on a special shaman life group for the Superstition exhibition. It was the painstaking preparation of this display group that Smithback wanted to include as one chapter in his book. Following Von Oster's gesture, Smithback stepped into the preparation area. He'd never seen this famous room before.
"So glad you could come see my workshop," Von Oster said. "Not many people down here now, what with these dreadful killings. Very glad indeed."
The workshop looked more like a bizarre industrial kitchen than anything else. Deep stainless steel tanks lined one wall. On the ceiling near the tanks hung massive pulleys, chains, and grappling hooks for handling the larger carcasses. A drain was drilled into the center of the floor, a small broken bone caught in its grill. In a far corner of the workshop, a stainless steel gurney stood, bearing a large animal. If it hadn't been for the large, hand-lettered sign taped to one leg of the gurney, Smithback wouldn't have guessed that the creature had once been a Sargasso Sea dugong. It was now almost fully decomposed. Around the corpse lay picks, pliers, tiny knives.
"Thanks for taking time to see me," Smithback managed. "Not at all," Von Oster exploded. "I wish we could give tours, but you know this area is off limits to the tourists, so more is the pity. You should have been here for the rhinoceros. Gott, she was something."
Walking briskly across the room, he showed Smithback the maceration tank containing the zebra carcass. Despite a hood drawing the vapors away, the smell was still strong. Von Oster lifted the lid and stood back like a proud cook.
"What you think of that?"
Smithback looked at the soupy brown liquid filling the vat. Under the muddy surface lay the macerating zebra carcass, its flesh and soft tissues slowly liquefying.
"It's a little ripe," Smithback said weakly. "What do you mean, ripe? It's just perfect. Under here we got the burner. It keeps the water at an even 95 degrees. See, first we gut the carcass and drop it in the vat here. Then it rot, and in 2 weeks we pull the plug and drain everything down the sink. What we got left is this big pile of greasy bones. So then we refill the vat and add a little alum and boil those bones. You don't want to boil them too long. They get soft."
Von Oster paused again for air.
"You know, just like when they cooked the chicken too long. Chewy. Bad. But those bones still greasy, so we wash them with the benzene. That makes them pure white."
"Mr. Van Oster," Smithback began. If he didn't redirect this interview quickly, he would never get out, and he couldn't stand the smell much longer.
"I was wondering if you could tell me a little about the shaman group you worked on. I'm writing a book about the Superstition exhibit. You remember our conversation?" Yeah, of course."
He charged over to a desk and pulled out some drawings. Smithback switched on his microcassette recorder.
"First, you paint the background on a double-curved surface, so you get no corners, see? You want the illusion of depth."
Von Oster began describing the process, his voice pitched with excitement.
"This is going to be good," Smithback thought. "The guy's a writer's dream."
Von Oster went on for a long time, stabbing the air, making sweeping gestures, taking deep breaths between his heavily accented sentences. When he was finished, he beamed at Smithback.
"Now, you want to see the bugs?" he asked.
Smithback couldn't resist. The bugs were famous. It was a process von Oster himself had invented, but was now in use by all the large natural history museums in the country. The beetles would strip a small carcass of its flesh, leaving behind a cleaned, perfectly articulated skeleton. The safe room that housed the beetles was hot and humid, and little larger than a closet. The beetles, called dermestids, came from Africa and lived in white porcelain tubs with slick sides, roofed with screens. The beetles slowly crawled over rows of dead, skinned animals.
"What are those things?"
Smithback asked, peering at the bug-covered carcasses inside the tubs.
"Bats," said von Oster. "Bats for Dr. Heisman's. It will take about 10 days to clean up those bats."
Between the odors and the bugs, Smithback had had enough. He stood up and extended his hand toward the old scientist.
"I gotta go. Thanks for the interview, and those bugs are really something."
"You're most welcome,"
von Oster responded.
"Now, wait. Interview, you say? Who are you writing this book for?"
The idea had suddenly occurred to him that he'd been interviewed.
"For the museum," said Smithback. "Rickman's in charge of it."
"Rickman?"
Von Oster's eyes suddenly narrowed.
"Yes, why?" Smithback asked. "You working for Rickman?"
von Oster said.
"Not really, she's just, well, interfering mostly," Smithback said.
Von Oster broke into a pink grin.
"Ach, she poisons that one. Why are you working for her?"
"That's just the way it happened," Smithback said, gratified at an ally. "You wouldn't believe the kind of crap she's put me through. Oh, God."
Von Oster clapped his hands.
"I believe it. I believe it. She making trouble everywhere. This exhibit, she making all kind of trouble."
Suddenly, Smithback was interested.
"How so?" he asked.
"She in there every day, saying this not good, that not good. God, that woman."
"That sounds like her," Smithback said with a grim smile. "So what wasn't good?"
"That, what you call it, that, Kotoga tribe stuff. I was in there just yesterday afternoon, and she was carrying on. Everybody leaves the exhibition. We bring in Kotoga figurine. Everybody had to drop work and leave."
"The figurine? What figurine? What's so sensitive about it?"
It suddenly occurred to Smithback that something so upsetting to Rickman might someday be useful to him.
"That Mbun figurine, big deal in the exhibition. I not know much about, but she was very upset, I tell you."
"Why?"
"Like I tell you, that figurine. You not heard? Lots of talk about it, very, very bad. I try not to hear."
"Well, what kind of talk would that be, for instance?"
Smithback listened to the old man for quite a while longer. Finally, he backed himself out of the workshop, von Oster pursuing as far as the elevator. As the doors rolled shut, the man was still talking.
"You unlucky working for her,"
he called after Smithback just before the elevator lurched upward. But Smithback didn't hear him. He was busy thinking. 20. As the afternoon drew to a close, Margot looked up wearily from her terminal. Stretching, she punched a command to the printer down the hall, then sat back, rubbing her eyes. Moriarty's case write-up was finally done. A little rough around the edges, perhaps, not as comprehensive as she would have liked, but she couldn't afford to spend any more time on it. Secretly, she was rather pleased, and found herself eager to take a printout up to Moriarty's office on the fourth floor of the Butterfield Observatory, where the project team for the Superstition exhibition was housed. She thumbed through her staff directory, looking for Moriarty's extension. Then she reached for her phone and dialed the 4-digit number.
"Exhibition Central."
There were loud goodbyes in the background. "Is George Moriarty there?" Margot asked.
"I think he's down at the exhibition. We're locking up here. Any message?"
No, thanks," Margot replied, hanging up. She looked at her watch. Almost 5. Curfew time. But the exhibition was being unveiled Friday evening, and she'd promised Moriarty the material. As she was about to get up, she remembered Frock's suggestion that she call Greg Kawakita. She sighed, picking up the phone again.
Better give him a try.
Chances are he'd be out of the building now, and she could just leave a message on phone mail.
"Greg Kawakita speaking."
came the familiar baritone voice. Greg, this is Margot Green. Stop sounding so apologetic. It's not like he's a department head or anything.
Hi, Margot, what's up?
She could hear the clacking of keys coming over the line. I have a favor to ask. It's a suggestion of Dr. Frock's, actually. I'm doing an analysis of some plant specimens used by the Kiribitu tribe, and he suggested I run them through your extrapolator. Perhaps it will find some genetic correspondences in the samples. There was a silence. Dr. Frock thought it might be a useful test of your program as well as a help to me, she urged. Kawakita paused.
Well, you know, Margot, I'd like to help you out, I really would, but the extrapolator really isn't in shape yet to be used by just anybody. I'm still chasing down bugs, and I couldn't vouch for the results.
Margot's face burned. Just anybody?
Sorry, that was a poor choice of words. You know what I mean. Besides, it's a really busy time for me, and this curfew won't help matters any. Tell you what, why don't you check with me again in a week or two, okay? Talk to you then.
The line went dead. Margot stood up, grabbed her jacket and purse, then went down the hall to retrieve her printout. She knew he was planning to postpone her indefinitely. Well, to hell with Kawakita. She'd hunt Moriarty down and give him the copy before she left. If nothing else, it might get her that guided tour of the exhibition, maybe find out what all the fuss was about. A few minutes later, Margot walked slowly across the deserted Salou Memorial Hall. Two guards were stationed at the entrance, and a single docent stood inside the information center, locking away ledgers and arranging sale items in preparation for the next day's visitors. Assuming there are any, thought Margot. Three policemen stood just under the huge bronze statue of Salou, talking among themselves. They didn't notice Margot. Margot found her thoughts returning to the morning's talk with Frock. If the killer wasn't found, the security measures could get stricter. Maybe her dissertation defense would be delayed, or the entire museum could be closed. Margot shook her head. If that happened, she was Massachusetts-bound for sure. She headed for the Walker Gallery and the rear entrance to the Superstition exhibition. To her dismay, the large iron doors were closed, and a velvet rope was suspended between two brass posts in front of them. A policeman stood beside the sign, motionless.
"Can I help you, miss?"
he said. His nameplate read F. Beauregard. "I'm going to see George Moriarty," Margot replied. "I think he's in the exhibition galleries. I have to give him something." She brandished the printout in front of the policeman, who looked unimpressed.
"Sorry, miss," he said. "It's past 5. You shouldn't be here. Besides," he said more gently, "the exhibition's been sealed until the opening."
"But..." Margot began to protest, then turned and walked back toward the rotunda with a sigh. After rounding a corner, she stopped. At the end of the empty hallway, she could see the dim vastness of the hall. Behind her, Officer F. Beauregard was out of sight around the corner. On impulse, she veered sharply left through a small, low passage that opened into another parallel walkway. Maybe it wasn't too late to find Moriarty after all. She moved up a wide flight of stairs, and looking carefully around before proceeding, walked slowly into a vaulted hall devoted to insects. Then she turned right and entered a gallery that ran around the second level of the Marine Hall. Like every place else in the museum, it felt eerie and deserted. Margot descended one of the twin sweeping staircases to the granite floor of the main hall. Moving more slowly now, she passed by a life-size walrus habitat group, and a meticulously constructed model of an underwater reef. Dioramas such as these, originally fashioned in the 30s and 40s, could no longer be made, she knew. They had become much too expensive to produce. At the far end of the hall was the entrance to the Wiseman Gallery, where the larger temporary exhibitions were held. This was one of the suite of galleries in which the Superstition exhibition was being mounted. Black paper covered the inside of the double glass doors, fronted by a large sign that read, "Gallery Closed. New Exhibition in Progress. Thank you for your understanding." The left-hand door was locked. The right one, however, pushed open easily. As casually as possible, she looked over her shoulder. Nobody. The door hissed shut behind her, and she found herself in a narrow crawl space between the outer walls of the gallery and the back of the exhibition proper. Plywood boards and large nails were strewn around in disarray, and electrical cables snaked across the floor. On her left, a huge structure of sheetrock and boards, hammered clumsily together and supported by wooden buttresses, looked very much like the backside of a Hollywood set. It was the side of the Superstition exhibition that no museum visitor would ever see. She moved carefully down the crawl space, scouting for some way to get into the exhibition. The light was poor, metal-shielded light bulbs spaced about 20 feet apart, and she didn't want to stumble and fall. Soon, she came across a small gap between the wooden panels, just big enough, she decided, to squeeze through. She found herself in a large, six-sided anteroom. Gothic arches in three of the walls framed passages that receded into the gloom. Most of the light came from several backlit photographs of shamans high up on the walls. She looked speculatively at the three exits. She had no idea where she was in the exhibition, where it began, where it ended, or which way she should go to find Moriarty. "George?" she called softly, somehow unable to raise her voice in the silence and gloom. She took the central passage to another dark hall, longer than the last, and crowded with exhibits. At intervals, a brilliant spot illuminated some artifact, a mask, a bone knife, a strange carving covered with nails. The artifacts appeared to float in the velvet darkness. Crazy, dim patterns of light and shadow played across the ceiling. At the far end of the gallery, the walls narrowed. Margot had the odd feeling that she was walking back into a deep cave. Pretty manipulative, she thought. She could see why Frock was upset. She went deeper into the gloom, hearing nothing but her own footsteps padding on the thick carpet. She couldn't see the exhibits until she was almost on top of them, and she wondered how she'd retrace her steps to the room of the shamans. Perhaps there would be an unlocked exit, a well-lit unlocked exit, someplace else in the exhibit. Ahead of her, the narrow hall forked. After a moment's hesitation, Margot chose the right-hand passage. As she continued, she noticed small alcoves to either side, each containing a single grotesque artifact. The silence was so intense that she found herself holding her breath. The hall widened into a chamber, and she stopped in front of a set of Maori tattooed heads. They weren't shrunken. The skulls were clearly still inside, preserved, the label said, by smoking. The eye sockets were stuffed with fibers, and the mahogany-colored skins glistened. The black, shriveled lips were drawn back from the teeth. There were six of them, a crowd grinning hysterically, bobbing in the night. The blue tattoos were breathtakingly complex, intricate spirals that intersected and re-intersected, curving in endless patterns around the cheeks and nose and chin. The tattooing had been done in life, the label said, and the heads preserved as a sign of respect. Just beyond, Margot could see the gallery narrowing to a point. A massive, squat totem pole stood before it, lit from beneath by a pale orange light. The shadows of giant wolf heads and birds with cruel hooked beaks thrust upward from the pole and splashed across the ceiling, gray against black. Certain she had reached a dead end, Margot approached the totem pole unwillingly. Then she noticed a small opening ahead and on the left, leading into an alcove. She continued slowly, walking as quietly as possible. Any thought of calling out again for Moriarty had long since vanished. Thank God I'm nowhere near the old basement, she thought. The alcove held a display of fetishes. Some were simple stones carved in the shapes of animals, but the majority were monsters depicting the darker side of human superstition. Another opening brought Margot into a long, narrow room. Thick black felt covered all of the room's surfaces, and a dim blue light filtered from hidden recesses. The ceiling was low above Margot's head. Smithback would have to go through here on his hands and knees, she thought. The room broadened into an octagonal room beneath a high-groined vault. A dappled light filtered down from the stained-glass depictions of medieval underworld set into the vaulted ceiling. Large windows dominated each wall. She approached the closest window and found herself looking down into a Mayan tomb. A skeleton lay in the center, covered with a thick layer of dust. Artifacts were scattered around the site. A gold breastplate sat on the ribcage, and gold rings encircled bony fingers. Painted pots were arranged in a semicircle around the skull. One of these contained an offering of tiny dried corn cobs. The next window displayed an Eskimo rock burial, including an Eskimo mummy bundle wrapped in skins. The next was even more startling, a lidless, rotting, European-style coffin, complete with corpse. The corpse was dressed in a much-decayed frock coat, tie, and tails, and was well on its way toward decomposition. Its head was bent stiffly toward Margot, as if prepared to tell her a secret, sightless eye sockets bulging, mouth ossified into a rictus of pain. She took a step backward. Good God, she thought. That's somebody's great-grandfather. The matter-of-fact tone of the label, which tastefully described the rituals associated with a typical 19th-century American burial, belied the visual hideousness of the scene. It's true, she thought. The museum is definitely taking a chance with stuff as strong as this. She decided to forego the other windows and proceeded through a low archway in the far side of the octagonal room. Beyond, the passage forked. To her left was a small cul-de-sac. To her right, a long, slender passage led into darkness. She didn't want to go that way. Not just yet. She wandered into the dead-end room and stopped suddenly. Then she moved forward to examine one of the cases more closely. The gallery dealt with the concept of ultimate evil in its many mythic forms. There were various images of a medieval devil. There was the Eskimo evil spirit, Tornarsuk. But what arrested her was a crude stone altar placed in the center of the gallery. Sitting on the altar, lit by a yellow spot, was a small figurine, carved in such detail it took Margot's breath away. Covered in scales, it crouched on all fours. Yet there was something, the long forearms, the angle of its head, that was disturbingly human. She shuddered. What kind of imagination gave rise to a being with both scales and hair? Her eyes dropped to the label. Mbun. This carving is a representation of the mad god Mbun, possibly carved by the Kathoga tribe of the upper Amazon basin. This savage god, also known as He Who Walks on All Fours, was much feared by the other indigenous tribes of the area. In local myth, the Kathoga tribe was said to be able to conjure Mbun at will and send him on errands of destruction against neighboring tribes. Very few Kathoga artifacts have ever been found, and this is the sole image of Mbun known to exist. Except for trace references in Amazonian legends, nothing else is known about the Kathoga or about their mysterious devil. Margot felt a chill creep over her scalp. She looked closer, repulsed by the reptilian features, the small wicked eyes, the talons. Three on each forelimb. Oh, dear God! It couldn't be. Suddenly, she realized that every instinct she had was telling her to keep absolutely still. A minute passed, then two. Then it came again, the sound that had galvanized her. An odd rustling, slow, deliberate, maddeningly soft. On the thick carpet, the footsteps had to be close. Very close. A horrible, goatish stench threatened to choke her. She looked around wildly, fighting down panic, searching for the safest exit. The darkness was complete. As quietly as possible, she moved out of the cul-de-sac and across the fork. Another rustling noise, and she was running, running, headlong through the darkness, past the ghoulish displays and leering statues that seemed to leap out of the blackness, down twisting forks and passages, trying always to take the most hidden path. At last, thoroughly lost and out of breath, she ducked into an alcove containing a display on primitive medicine. Gasping, she crouched behind a case holding a trepanned human skull upon an iron pole. She hid in its shadow, listening. There was nothing. No noise. No movement. She waited as her breath slowed and reason returned. There was nothing out there. There had never been anything out there. In fact, it was her overzealous imagination, fueled by this nightmarish tour. I was foolish to sneak in, she thought. Now I don't know if I'll ever want to come back, even on the busiest Saturday. Anyway, she had to find a way out. It was late now, and she hoped people were still around to hear her knocking should she come up against a locked exit. It would be embarrassing having to explain herself to a guard or policeman, but at least she'd be out. She peeked over the case lid. Even if it had all been her imagination, she didn't care to go back in the same direction. Holding her breath, she stepped quietly out, then listened. Nothing. She turned left and moved slowly down the corridor, searching for a likely-looking route out of the exhibit. At a large fork, she stopped, eyes straining in the darkness, debating which of the branching pathways to take. Shouldn't there be exit signs? Guess they haven't been installed yet. Typical. But the hall to her left looked promising. The passage seemed to open up into a large foyer ahead in the blackness where sight failed. Movement registered in her peripheral vision. Body frozen, she glanced hesitatingly to the right. A shadow, black against black, was gliding stealthily toward her, moving with an inky sinuousness over the display cases and grinning artifacts. With a speed born of horror, she shot down the passage. She felt, more than saw, the walls of the passage roll back and widen about her. Then she saw twin slits of vertical light ahead, outlining a large double doorway. Without slackening her pace, she threw herself against it. The doors flew back, and something on the far side clattered. Dim light rushed in, the subdued red light of a museum at night. Cool air moved across her cheek. Weeping now, she slammed the doors closed and leaned against them, eyes shut, forehead pressed against the cold metal, sobbing, fighting to catch her breath. From the crimson gloom behind her came the unmistakable sound of something clearing its throat. Superstition Exhibition Part 2 21
What's going on here?
Came the stern voice. Margot whirled around and almost collapsed with relief.
Officer Beauregard, there's...
She began in mid-sentence. F. Beauregard, who was writing the brass posts that the swinging door had knocked over, looked up at the sound of his name.
Hey, you're the girl who tried to get in earlier.
The policeman's eyes narrowed.
What's wrong, miss? Can't take no for an answer?
Officer, there's a...
Margot tried to start again, then faltered. The officer stepped back and folded his arms across his chest, waiting. Then a look of surprise crossed his face.
What the hell? Hey, you okay, lady?
Margot was slumped over, laughing or crying, she wasn't sure which, and wiping tears from her face. The policeman freed one folded hand and took her arm.
I think you should come with me.
The implications of that last sentence, sitting in a room full of policemen, telling her story again and again, maybe having Dr. Frock or even Dr. Wright called in, having to go back into that exhibition, forced Margot to straighten up.
They'll just think I'm crazy. Oh, no, that's not necessary, she said, snuffling. I just had a bit of a scare.
Officer Beauregard looked unconvinced.
I still think we should go talk to Lieutenant Augusta.
With his other hand, he pulled a large leather-bound notebook out of his back pocket.
What's your name? He asked. I'll have to make a report.
It was clear he wouldn't let her go until she gave him the information.
My name's Margot Green, she said finally. I'm a graduate student working under Dr. Frock. I was doing an assignment for George Moriarty. He's curating this exhibition. But you were right. Nobody was in there.
She gently freed her arm from the policeman's grip as she spoke. Then she started backing away towards Salou Memorial Hall, still talking. Officer Beauregard watched her, and finally, with a shrug, he flipped open the notebook and started writing. Back in the hall, Margot paused. She couldn't go back to her office. It was almost 6, and the curfew was sure to be enforced by now. She didn't want to go home. She couldn't go home, not just yet. Then she remembered Moriarty's copy. She pressed one elbow against her side. Sure enough, her carryall was still there, hanging unnoticed through the ordeal. She stood still another moment, then walked over to the deserted information kiosk. She picked up the receiver of an internal phone and dialed. One ring, then...
Moriarty here.
George, it's Margot Green.
Hi, Margot, what's up?
I'm in the Saloo Hall. I just came from the exhibition.
My exhibition? What were you doing there? Who let you in?
I was looking for you. I wanted to give you the Cameroon copy. Were you in there?
She felt panic rising once again to the surface.
No. The exhibition's supposed to be sealed in preparation for Friday night's opening. Why?
Margot was breathing deeply, trying to control herself. Her hands were trembling and the receiver knocked against her ear.
What did you think of it?
Moriarty asked curiously. A hysterical giggle escaped Margot.
Scary.
We brought in some experts to work out the lighting and the placement of the visuals. Dr. Cuthbert even hired the man who designed Fantasy World's haunted mausoleum. That's considered the best in the world, you know.
Margot finally trusted herself to speak again.
George, something was in that exhibition with me.
A security guard on the far side of the hall had spotted her and was walking in her direction.
What do you mean, something?
Exactly that!
Suddenly, she was back in the exhibit, in the dark beside that horrible figurine. She remembered the bitter taste of terror in her mouth.
Hey, stop shouting. Look, let's go to the bones and talk this over. We're both supposed to be out of the museum anyway. I hear what you're saying, but I don't understand it.
The bones, as it was called by everyone in the museum, was known to other local residents as the Blarney Stone Tavern. Its unimposing facade was nestled between two huge ornate co-op buildings directly across 72nd Street from the museum's southern entrance. Unlike typical Upper West Side fern bars, the Blarney Stone did not serve hare pâté or five flavors of mineral water, but you could get homemade meatloaf and a pitcher of harp for $10. Museum staffers called it the Bones because Boylan, the owner, had hammered and wired an amazing number of bones into every available flat surface. The walls were lined with countless femurs and tibias, arranged in neat ivory ranks like bamboo matting. Metatarsals, scapulas, and patellas traced bizarre mosaics across the ceiling. Craniums from strange mammals were lodged in every conceivable niche. Where he got the bones was a mystery, but some claimed he raided the museum at night.
People bring him in, is all Boylan would ever say, shrugging his shoulders.
Naturally, the place was a favorite hangout among the museum staff. The Bones was doing brisk business, and Moriarty and Margot had to push their way back through the crowd to an empty booth. Looking around, Margot spotted several museum staffers, including Bill Smithback. The writer was seated at the bar, talking animatedly to a slender blonde woman.
Okay, Moriarty said, raising his voice over the babble. Now, what were you saying over the phone? I'm not quite sure I caught it.
Margot took a deep breath.
I went down to the exhibition to give you the copy. It was dark. Something was in there, following me, chasing me.
There's that word again, something. Why do you say that?
Margot shook her head impatiently.
Don't ask me to explain. There were these sounds, like padded steps. They were so stealthy, so deliberate,
She shrugged, at a loss.
And there was this strange smell, too. It was horrible.
Look, Margot, Moriarty began, then paused while the waitress took their drink orders.
That exhibition was designed to be creepy. You told me yourself that Frock and others consider it too sensational. I can imagine what it must have been like, being locked in there alone in the dark.
In other words, I just imagined it. Margot laughed, mirthlessly.
You don't know how much I'd like to believe that.
The drinks arrived, a light beer for Margot and a pint of Guinness for Moriarty, topped with the requisite half-inch of creamy foam. Moriarty sipped it critically. These killings, all the rumors that have been going around, he said, taking a deep draft. I probably would have reacted the same way. Margot, calmer now, spoke hesitantly.
George, that Cathoga figurine in the exhibition.
Mbun? What about it?
Its front legs have three claws.
Moriarty was enjoying the Guinness.
I know. It's a marvelous piece of sculpture, one of the highlights of the show. Of course, though I hate to admit it, I suppose its biggest attraction is the curse.
Margot took an exploratory sip from her beer.
George, I want you to tell me, in as much detail as you can, what you know about the Mbun curse.
A shout came bellowing over the din of conversation. Looking up, Margot saw Smithback appear out of the smoky gloom, carrying an armful of notebooks, his hair backlit and sticking out from his head at a variety of angles. The woman he'd been talking to at the bar was nowhere to be seen.
"A meeting of the shutouts," he said. "This curfew is a real pain. God save me from policemen and PR directors."
Uninvited, he dropped his notebooks on the table and slid in next to Margot.
"I've heard that the police are going to start interviewing those working in the vicinity of the murders," he said. "Guess that means you, Margot."
"Mine's set for next week," Margot replied.
"I haven't heard anything about it," said Moriarty.
He didn't look pleased at Smithback's appearance.
"Well, you don't have much to worry about, perched up in that garret of yours," Smithback told Moriarty. "The museum beast probably can't climb stairs anyway."
"You're in a foul mood this evening," Margot said to Smithback. "Did Rickman perform another amputation on your manuscript?"
Smithback was still talking to Moriarty.
"Actually, you're just the man I wanted to see. I've got a question for you."
The waitress came by again, and Smithback waved his hand.
"McAllen, straight up."
"Okay," Smithback went on. "What I wanted to know is, what's the story behind this Mbun figurine?"
There was a stunned silence. Smithback looked from Moriarty to Margot.
"What'd I say?"
"We were just talking about Mbun," Margot said uncertainly.
"Yeah?" Smithback said. "Small world. Anyway, that old Austrian in the bug room, Von Oster, told me he heard Rickman kicking up a fuss about Mbun being put on display. Something about sensitive issues, so I did a little digging."
The scotch arrived, and Smithback held the glass high in a silent toast, then tossed it off.
"I've obtained a little background so far," he continued. "It seems there was this tribe along the upper Jingu River in the Amazon, the Kothoga. They'd apparently been a bad lot, supernatural dabbling, human sacrifice a whole bit. Since the old boys hadn't left many traces around, anthropologists assumed they'd died out centuries ago, and all that remained was a bunch of myths circulated by local tribes."
"I know something of this," Moriarty began. "Margot and I were just discussing it, except not everybody felt..."
I know, hold your water."
Moriarty settled back, looking annoyed. He was more used to giving lectures than listening to them.
"Anyway, several years ago, there was this guy named Whittlesey at the museum. He mounted an expedition to the upper Jingu, purportedly to search for traces of the Kothoga, artifacts, ancient dwelling sites, whatever."
Smithback leaned forward conspiratorially.
"But what Whittlesey didn't tell anybody was that he wasn't just going in search of this old tribe's traces. He was going in search of the tribe itself. He'd got it into his noggin that the Kothoga still existed, and he was pretty certain he could locate them. He developed something he called myth triangulation."
This time, Moriarty wouldn't be stopped.
"That's where you locate all the spots on a map where legends about a certain people or place are heard, identify the areas where the legends are most detailed and consistent, and locate the exact center of this myth region. That's where the source of the myth cycles is most likely to be found."
Smithback looked at Moriarty for a moment.
"No kidding," he said. "Anyway, this Whittlesey goes off in 1987 and disappears into the Amazon rainforest, never to be seen again."
"Von Oster told you all this?"
Moriarty rolled his eyes.
"Tiresome old guy." "He may be tiresome, but he knows a hell of a lot about this museum."
Smithback examined his empty glass forlornly.
"Apparently, there was a big confrontation in the jungle, and most of the expedition team started back early. They'd found something so important they wanted to leave right away, and Whittlesey disagreed. He stayed along with a fella named Crocker. Apparently, they both died in the jungle. But when I asked Von Oster for more details about this Mbun figurine, he suddenly clammed up."
Smithback stretched languorously and began looking for the waitress.
"Guess I'll have to hunt down somebody who was part of that expedition."
"Lots of luck," Margot said. They were all killed in a plane crash coming back. Smithback peered at her intently.
No shit. And how do you know that?
Margot hesitated, remembering Pendergast's request for confidentiality. Then she thought of Frock and how he'd gripped her hand so fiercely that morning.
We can't miss this opportunity. We must not let this chance slip us by.
I'll tell you what I know, she said slowly. But you must keep this to yourselves. And you must agree to help me in any way you can. Be careful, Margot, Moriarty cautioned.
Help you? Sure, no problem, said Smithback. With what, by the way?
Hesitantly, Margot told them about the meeting with Pendergast in the secure room, the casts of the claw and wound, the crates, Cuthbert's story. Then she described the sculpture of Mbun she'd seen in the exhibition, omitting her panic and flight. She knew Smithback wouldn't believe her any more than Moriarty had. So what I was asking George when you came up, she concluded, is exactly what he knows about this curse of the Cathoga. Moriarty shrugged. Not all that much, really. In local legend, the Cathoga tribe was a shadowy group, a witch doctor cult. They were supposed to be able to control demons. There was a creature, a familiar, if you will, they used for vengeance killings. That was Mbun, he who walks on all fours. Then Whittlesey came across this figurine and some other objects, packed them up, and sent them back to the museum. Of course, such disturbance of sacred object has been done countless times before. But then, when he gets lost in the jungle and never comes out, and the rest of the expedition dies on the return trip, he shrugged his shoulders. The curse.
And now people are dying in the museum, Margot said.
What are you saying? That the Mbun curse, the stories of a museum beast, and these killings are all linked? Asked Moriarty. Come on, Margot, don't read too much into it. She looked at him intently.
Didn't you tell me that Cuthbert kept the figurine out of the exhibition until the last minute?
That's right, Moriarty said. He handled all the work on that relic himself. Not unusual, considering it's such a valuable piece. As for delaying its placement in the exhibition, that was Rickman's idea, I believe. Probably thought it would generate more interest.
I doubt it, Smithback replied. That's not the way her mind works. If anything, she was trying to avoid interest. Blows scandal at her, and she shrivels up like a moth in a flame, he chuckled.
Just what's your interest in all this, anyway? Moriarty demanded.
You don't think a dusty old artifact would interest me? Smithback finally caught the eye of the waitress and ordered another round for the table.
Well, it's obvious Rickman wouldn't let you write about it, Margot said.
Smithback made a face.
Too true. It might offend all the ethnic Cathoga tribesmen in New York. Actually, it's because Von Oster said that Rickman was bent out of shape about this. So I thought maybe I could dig around, get some dirt. Something that will put me in a better bargaining position when our next tete-a-tete comes along. You know, this chapter stays or I'm taking the Whittlesey story to Smithsonian Magazine, that sort of thing.
Now wait a minute, Margot said. I didn't take you into my confidence just so you could make some money off it. Don't you understand? We have to learn more about these crates. Whatever is killing people wants something that's in them. We have to find out what it is.
What we really need to do is find that journal, Smithback said.
But Cuthbert says it's been lost, Margot said.
Have you checked the accession database? Smithback said. Maybe there's some information there. I'd do it myself, but my security rating is rock bottom.
So is mine, Margot replied. And it hasn't been my day for computers. She told them about her talk with Kawakita.
Well, how about Moriarty here? Smithback said. You're a computer whiz, right? Besides, as an assistant curator, you have high security access.
I think you should let the authorities handle this. Moriarty drew back, dignified. This isn't for us to mess around with. Don't you understand? Margot pleaded. Nobody knows what we're dealing with here. People's lives, perhaps the museum's future, are at stake. I know your motives are good, Margot, Moriarty said, but I don't trust Bill's.
My motives are pure as the Pierian spring, Smithback retorted. Rickman is storming the citadel of journalistic truth. I'm just looking to defend the ramparts.
Wouldn't it be easier to just do what Rickman wants? Moriarty asked. I think your vendetta is a little childish, and you know what? You won't win.
The drinks came, and Smithback tossed his off and exhaled with gusto.
Someday I'll get that bitch, he said.
22. Beauregard finished the entry, then stuffed his notebook in a back pocket. He knew he really ought to call the incident in. Hell with it. That girl had looked so scared it was obvious she wasn't up to anything. He'd make his report when he got the chance, and no sooner. Beauregard was in a bad mood. He didn't like doorshaker duty. Still, it'd be directing traffic at a broken light, and it made a good impression down at Orion's.
Yeah, he would say. I'm assigned to the museum case. Sorry, can't talk about it.
For a museum, this place is damn quiet, Beauregard thought. He supposed on a normal day the museum would be bustling with activity. But the museum hadn't been normal since Sunday. At least during the day, staff members had come in and out of the new exhibition halls. But then they'd closed it off for the opening. Except with written permission from Dr. Cuthbert, you couldn't get in unless you were police or security on official business. Thank God his shift ended at 6 and he could look forward to 2 days away from this place. A solo fishing trip to the Catskills. He'd been looking forward to it for weeks. Beauregard ran his hand reassuringly along the holster of his S&W 38 special. Ready for action, as always. And on his other hip, a shot-shell pistol loaded with enough capstan to bring an elephant to his knees. Behind him, Beauregard heard a muffled pattering sound. He spun around, heart suddenly racing, to face the closed doors of the exhibition. He located the key, unlocked the doors, and peered in.
Who's there?
Only a cool breeze fanned his cheek. He let the doors close and tested the lock. You could come out, but you couldn't go in. That girl must have gone in through the front entrance. But wasn't that kept locked, too? They never told him anything. The sound came again. Well, hell, he thought. It ain't my job to check inside. Can't let anyone into the exhibition, never said anything about anyone coming out. Beauregard started humming a tune, tapping the beat on his thigh with 2 fingers. 10 more minutes and he'd be out of this frigging spook house. The sound came again. Beauregard unlocked the doors a second time and stuck his head deep inside. He could see some dim shapes. Exhibition cases, a gloomy-looking entranceway.
This is a police officer. You in there, respond.
The cases were dark, the walls vague shadows. No answer. Withdrawing, Beauregard pulled out his radio.
Beauregard to Ops, do you copy?
TDN, what's up?
Reporting noises at the exhibition's rear exit.
What kind of noises?
Uncertain. Sounds like someone's in there.
There was some talk and a stifled laugh over the band.
Fred.
What?
Beauregard was growing more irritated by the minute. The dispatcher in the situation room was a first-class asshole.
Better not go in there.
Why not?
It might be the monster, Fred. Might get ya.
Go to hell,
Fred muttered under his breath. He wasn't supposed to investigate anything without backup, and the dispatcher knew it. A scratching noise came from behind the doors, as if something with nails was scrabbling against it. Beauregard felt his breath come hard and fast. His radio squawked.
Seen the monster yet?
Came the voice. Trying to keep his voice as neutral as possible, Beauregard said,
Repeat. Reporting unidentified sounds in the exhibition. Request backup to investigate.
He wants backup.
There was the sound of muffled laughter.
Fred, we don't have any backup. Everyone's busy.
Listen, said Beauregard, losing his temper. Who's that with you? Why don't you send him down?
McNitt. He's on a coffee break, right, McNitt?
Beauregard heard some more laughter. Beauregard switched off the radio. Fuck those guys, he thought. Some professionalism. He just hoped the lieutenant was listening in on that frequency. He waited in the dark hallway. 5 more minutes and I'm history.
TDN calling Beauregard. You read?
10-4, said Beauregard.
McNitt there yet?
No, said Beauregard. He finally finished his coffee break.
Hey, I was just kidding around,
TDN said a little nervously.
I sent him right up.
Well, he's lost then, said Beauregard. And my duty ends in 5 minutes. I'm off the next 48 and nothing's going to interfere with that. You better radio him. Jesus.
He isn't reading.
An idea suddenly occurred to Beauregard. How did McNitt go? Did he take the Section 17 elevator, the one behind the sit room?
Yep, that's what I told him. Section 17 elevator. I got this map, same one you have.
So in order to get here, he has to go through the exhibition. That was real smart. You should have sent him up through food service.
Hey, don't talk to me about smart, Freddy boy. He's the one who's lost. Call me when he arrives.
One way or another, I'm out of here in 5 minutes, said Beauregard. It'll be Effinger's headache then, over and out. That was when Beauregard heard a sudden commotion from the exhibition. There was a sound like a muffled thud. Jesus, he thought. McNitt! He unlocked the doors and went in, unsnapping the holster of his .38. TDN placed another donut in his mouth and chewed, swallowing it with a mouthful of coffee. The radio hissed.
McNitt to Ops. Come in, TDN.
10-4, where the hell are you?
I'm at the rear entrance. Beauregard ain't here. I can't raise him or anything.
Let me try. He punched the transmitter. TDN calling Beauregard. Fred, come in. TDN calling Beauregard. Hey, McNitt, I think he got pissed off and went home. His shift just ended. How did you get up there, anyway?
I went the way you said, but when I got to the front end of the exhibition, it was locked, so I had to go around. Didn't have my keys. Got a little lost.
Stay tight, all right? His relief should arrive any minute. Effinger, it says here. Radio me when he arrives and then come on back.
Here comes Effinger now. You gonna report Beauregard?
You kidding? I'm no damn babysitter. 23. D'Agosta looked over at Pendergast, reclining in the shabby back seat of the Buick. Jesus, he thought. A guy like Pendergast ought to pull at least a late model town car. Instead, they gave him a 4-year-old Buick and a driver who could barely speak English. Pendergast's eyes were half closed.
Turn on 86th and take the Central Park transverse, shouted D'Agosta.
The driver swerved across two lanes of Central Park West and roared into the transverse.
Take 5th to 65th and go across, said D'Agosta. Then go one block north on 3rd and take a right at 66th.
59 faster, said the driver, in a thick Middle Eastern accent.
Not in the evening rush hour, called D'Agosta.
Christ, they couldn't even find a driver who knew his way around the city. As the car swerved and rattled down the avenue, the driver flew on past 65th Street.
What the hell are you doing? Said D'Agosta. You just missed 65th.
Apology,
said the driver, turning down 61st into a massive traffic jam.
I can't believe this, D'Agosta said to Pendergast. You ought to have this joker fired.
Pendergast smiled, his eyes still half closed. He was, shall we say, a gift of the New York office. But the delay will give us a chance to talk. He settled back into the torn seat. Pendergast had spent the last half of the afternoon at Jolly's autopsy. D'Agosta had declined the invitation. This lab found several kinds of DNA in our sample, Pendergast continued. One was human, the other from a gecko. D'Agosta looked at him.
Gecko? What's a gecko? He asked.
A kind of lizard. Harmless enough. They like to sit on walls and bask in the sun. When I was a child, we rented a villa overlooking the Mediterranean one summer, and the walls were covered with them. At any rate, the results were so surprising to the lab technician that he thought it was a joke. He opened his briefcase. Here's the autopsy report on Jolly. There's nothing much new, I'm afraid. Same M.O., body horrifically mauled,
thalamoid region of the brain removed. The coroner's office has estimated that to create such deep lacerations in a single stroke, required force would exceed, he consulted a typewritten sheet, twice what a strong human male can achieve. Needless to say, it's